Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
The Talmud is the central pillar supporting the entire spiritual and intellectual edifice of Jewish life. So wrote Rabbi Adin Evan Israel Steinsaltz. Not only did Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz publish an English translation and commentary of the entire Talmud in 42 volumes, the Noah edition Koran Talmud Bavli, he also published a guide for studying the Talmud titled The Essential Talmud and a reference guide to the Talmud and Talmudic Images, which represents the life and historical context of 13 key Talmudic sages. Join us as we speak with Rabbi Meni Evan Israel about his father's lifelong work of Talmudic scholarship, as published with Koren Publishers. You're listening to New Books in Jewish Studies, a channel of the New Books Network, and I'm Michael Morales, your host. Rabbi Meni Evan Israel serves as the executive director of the Steinsaltz Center, which oversees the teachings and publications of his father, Rabbi Adin Evan Israel Steinsaltz, and which has recently put out an app, the Steinsaltz Daily Study. Rabbi Meni, welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Rabbi Meni, tell us about the significant place of the Talmud in the scholarship of your father, of blessed memory, Rabbi Adin Evan Israel Steinsaltz. How many years did he spend translating and commentating on the Talmud?
So my father, apparently it was my father's first epiphany about the way the knowledge of the Jewish people has to be disseminated, and the importance of the Talmud became something that he moved from a archaic book meant for the few to, again, bringing back to its glory days, that which was, you know, everybody's supposed to learn it as the key of understanding Jewish thought and Jewish understanding. But more so, even though it's dealing a lot with Jewish law, because it's a law book in a sense, a lot of it is cultural. A lot of it is teaching us the stories and the culture and the heritage of our people. A lot of the stories also have a historical benefit, as it's not censored. In the sense that the sages who are the heroes of the book, not of the book, it's a much more of a study material, much more of a curricular concept, is they're not limited to speak only about law. They can speak about everything. They can speak about any possible topic. But the most important thing is that in our tradition, without learning Talmud, you disappear. We see it in communities that used to learn Talmud and then for whatever reason stopped learning Talmud. If it was burning the Talmud or the fact there was no leadership to teach Talmud, those communities eventually literally disappeared. Anyway, my father actually holds it as a historical truth. I'm struggling with it. It's a historical truth or historical practicality. I mean, it's a small detail because there were some communities that were learning Talmud, but it was not the emphasis of the community. And again, you got the same result. The most famous one, if I may, is the community in New Amsterdam, happened to be led in New York, is that we know the community there arrived very early, talking about early 17th century, so to speak, 18th century, early, talking about 17-something, and they had a Jewish community, was very big, and they disappeared. in the very few, if at all, any remnants of the old Jewish community of 300 years ago. And the main reason was because it never developed. They were merchants, ship builders, ship owners, and they were a member of the Netherlands West Indies Company, in or East Whiting, I don't remember which one. But the thing in reality is they didn't learn, and then they basically disappeared. The most devastating example of that is Italy. It's almost a proof, again, it's almost that once the Talmud was burning in Rome, even though the Jews were kept more or less alive and under the scrutiny of the Pope, the learning level, the growth of the community really was held back. And we think it's because of that learning Talmud. The Talmud is really the most essential book of the Jewish people, even though, again, with the respect to the Bible. Obviously, the Bible is the core base of the Talmud. The Talmud is based on it. So my father, when he was very young, my grandfather told him that he doesn't care if he's becoming a heretic. That doesn't bother him. But he cannot be ignoramus. And by us, being ignoramus is really the ability to learn Talmud. That is really where the line in the sand, the line that described yes and no, is that particular line of learning Talmud. So he, I think from a very young age, he realizes that this is the way. There's no other way around it. You need to have either way a path to understand it. And the biggest challenge, the first challenge that he saw was before the system of the Talmud. The first challenge he saw was a language barrier. Talmud is written with a mixture of Hebrew and Aramaic. Hebrew is a language that literally is dead. Every time we went to exile, we adopted the local language. That's the reason we have Yiddish, we have Ladino. Apparently, there's many more options and variation of it. But in general, so in Aramaic was the same thing. So again, those languages are very old languages, and in a lot of ways, they're dead languages. I mean, talking about the language that only 7 million people or 10 million people speak, you know, it's not really a very live language, the size of the world. And he took upon himself to first of all translate it. He took this progress on him over the earliest copy of it, we saw in 1961. He was then 24. 24? Yeah. It was 24. I mean, the fact that somebody has the courage to do such a thing was already outstanding, and he took upon himself to do this commentary to make it accessible and available to, obviously, the natural thing is to first of all start with the Israelis around him and the Jewish nation as a Jewish people as a second stage, but obviously is opening the Talmud now for the first time in history in an open way, not hiding anything, not censoring anything, that self-censor, outside censor, really everything open. In the whole, the people will accept it as a knowledge book, and not necessarily as a 100% factual book or 100% a law-binding book. Even our laws, as much as this book is very involved with this, involved the law, a lot of the laws change. Like, they know the progress, they immerse, they move from where they were in the first century to where they move in the fifth century or ninth century. And then eventually they get to the situation to where they are at today. And even that is changed constantly, which is a normal process of a law. You know, we just read the Torah portion of Shoftim. Shoftim, which deals with the rules of judges. I mean, even though it's have six lines about it, it's not like that advanced. But the main line there, which is really the base of the Jewish concept of oral law, the law was translated from ear to mouth, so to speak, from mouth to ear, generation to generation. That is based on a line in this Torah portion that says you should come to the judge and the priest that will be in your days. And the judge and the priest in your days is the one who made the decision. There's a very, very famous story about the rabbi of Krakow. Rabbi of Krakow, after the war, had to go and the community just came back from the Holocaust. They were dispersed. They were sad. And the typical way it is, people were, you know, fighting. You know, they didn't know who's going to be in charge and not be in charge. And you know it's going to have very limited time. I mean, they all understood that the goal was to get to the land of Israel, but there was a lot of issues. And when you get the city of Krakow, there's a big synagogue there, synagogue of the Rama. Rama was Moshe Isserlish, which was the commentator on the Shulchan Aruch, which is the Jewish code of law, and he lived there. And his chair is still in existence, even though after destruction, nobody dared to touch it. And nobody used to sit on it because it's a matter of respect. But this guy had no choice. He said, I'm going to sit on the chair because people sit and have the courage to sit in the chair. They will listen to me because I'm in this generation. I'm the generation they need, and they have to listen to me. So the same thing applies. The Rav was really the base of oral law. My father spent 45 years doing it, and he finished the actual work was done by in 2010, which is literally close to 60 years of work on it, 50 years of work on it. The main purpose was because I think very early, maybe 20 years into this, out of the 50, he already had a variety of other projects that he was involved with. And because of that other project he was involved with, he, you know, the amount of effort and time and money that, you know, this thing costs, as usual, tremendous amount of resources were allocated to the other things he was doing. And the same thing applied for good translators, good editors, and good researchers. If you have good people who can do either job also, and writing and translating is just a secondary work, you let them do that. You know, and I think that's one reason it took so long. But he finally finished in 2010. It was also a big celebration, big commemoration. The most annoying question he got from people was, so Rabbi, after you accomplish your life mission, what are you going to do now? And my father, used to look at them like they fell from a tree. I mean, like, for him, the fact that he finished the Talmud was, you know, I can't tell you he was not happy. He was clear for him that there are thousands of other projects that can be done. It was obvious to him that this is not enough. You know, it's not something, okay, you do this and you go home and you tap on your shoulder and say, yay. He understood that this is just one step in the process of work.
Well, aside from the 42 volumes of the Talmud in English translation with commentary, we want to highlight a few other books Rabbi Evan Israel wrote about the Talmud. The first is The Essential Talmud. Tell us about how this would be helpful for the average reader.
Okay, so Essential Talmud is really not, as much as it says, Essential Talmud is in the sense of, oh, this is the basic of learning. No, it's really the basic about the Talmud. It will give you across information, essential information, that's hence the key word here, about what a Talmud was, how it was created, what was the progress, how it's been done, what's the important notion to put attention to, understand the length and the effort it took to make this kind of book and how significant it is. The book divides to a variety of parts that we're basically dealing with, again, the historical concept, historical background, the merit of the work. Each one of those sections brought another aspect of my father's work, my father's understanding of the Talmud, to fruition. He makes a variety of statements in the book about what Talmud is and how important it is, that it was described in language before. And it's really the key book to understand. To understand the Talmud is a short glimpse. It's also a very short book, I mean, relatively speaking. It's 150 pages, more or less. And it's a book that's been around almost, I would like to say, about 40, 45 years already in the market. Keep selling, people buying it. I think it's a good book. It's very clear what's the agenda of the book. It's teach you what is Talmud. Part of the problem is that even if you talk a normal kid here in Israel who went to rabbinical school from a young age, was, you know, even part of maybe his elementary school or high school, have no idea what a Talmud is, right? You go to school and hear Talmud. It's like the first time you go to English Lit, right? You go to English Lit and they give you Shakespeare and you sit there like an idiot because you have no idea what Shakespeare's background. It's a famous line. I mean, you take the famous Venice of Merchant quote, right? If it's raining, it will not be wet, so on and so forth, which is, it looked like a pure racism, like it will not pass today. But if you take the context context of William Shakespeare being in England, that he did not see a Jew ever, as the Jews were expelled already. The fact that he wrote that Jews have emotions, forget about it. He doesn't depict them as the nicest person in the world. It's the fact that he can talk about it, the fact that he can be in the conversation, that is already a huge merit. So you judge the book by not by its cover, but really by its content and the content of time. So the Central Talmud will give you the references of the time. Because the Talmud, in our major works, the Talmud is the third book in the process, right? We have the Bible, then we have the Mishnah, which is basically the rabbi commentating on the commandments in the Torah. Torah has 630 commandments, maybe more, of practical action we have to do that don't come with explanation, really. Don't come with a manual how to do that. It takes something as simple as respecting your father and your mother, right? Which is obvious. Obviously, it's an obvious commandment, but apparently God thought it's important enough to put in 10 commandments. But it doesn't come with a guideline. The only guideline we know is that is in later in the Torah, in the Bible, mentioned you should not hit your parents and you should not curse your parents. Okay? But that is hardly answering the question, what is respecting our parents? How far I have to go with it? If my parents insult me, do I still have to respect them? If my parents hurt me, do I still have to care about it? And so on and so forth. I mean, those kind of questions have been, first of all, asked and to some extent answered in the Mishnah. And then the third tier is the Talmud. The Talmud took whatever conversation we had, both in the written Mishnah and the written Bible, to everything we have orally and everything else we have by tradition that we developed. So the Talmud is that. So without getting I think the Central Talmud is a must read. Anybody who wants to open the Talmud should read this book, which again, this is a shorter version or a more concise version of the later book, which is called the Reference Guide of the Talmud. But as a reference guide, it's much more reference than essential. It's stuff that most people will never attach. I mean, measurement in the Talmud. There's a small dictionary in the reference guide that most people don't ever going to use unless they're going to learn Talmud in the original language, which is a small amount of people. So the Central Talmud will give you the background, the method, the logic, the rationale behind it, and of course the importance and the historical significance of the book. It's clearly from the reaction of people around us. The Talmud was, and sadly enough, some negative websites, still the source of all evil in the world. Now, mainly the main reason is because people judge the book on our terms, on our modern days, even though terms have changed, life changed, situation changed, things that we never imagined in the past are no longer applicable. I give an example of one of the most known examples in the Talmud is about the rules of doing business with somebody who's idol worshiper. Okay? So the Mishnah in Tractate Idol Worship, that's called the Tractate name, says not to do business with somebody who's idol worshiper 3 days before, 3 days after, before his holiday. Right? So if you take any holiday that we celebrate today in the world, they take Say, for example, I don't know, a New Year's Eve. Theoretically, if I put this in a context that is not Jewish holiday, it's automatically getting very close to the notion of idol worship. And if I cannot do business with you 3 days before, 3 days after, when am I going to do business? There's no time. We have, as we all know, and especially if you go back to the old time, we're not the only one who celebrate Sunday, Saturday and Sunday. The fact that some people celebrate every Sunday was a common practice both in Persia and other places. Again, did they adapt from us? We don't know. But in reality speaking, if I cannot do business with somebody on Sunday because it's not my holiday, so basically it's keeping me having one day to do business, which is Wednesday, which is very, very limited to what a person can do. So the Mishnah brings it, right? And Talmud immediately talk about it. But then later commentator explained it. This is not realistic. Because life is changing. That is extremely important to understand that even in the context of Talmud. The Talmud is not a book that was written in 10 years or 20 years. It was written and accumulated by variety of sages and scholars throughout historical turmoil or historical rest for hundreds of years. And the Talmud, the Sefer Talmud also brings you the reality that not everything in the book is holding position. Certain facts are no longer facts. Example, the Talmud believed, there's a part of the Talmud that believed that there's a human being that is half human, half earth. Okay? Why they got into this, don't know. They might confuse it with, you know, monkeys who are trees. I think not a new kind of monkey never saw. You know, I can imagine a thousand things, but clearly we're not there yet, right? We're not there anymore. Our belief is moving forward, right? Now, in the other side, there's reference in the Talmud that the world is round over in the 5th century. Now, obviously, we didn't accept that till much later in the history of the world. But that's the Talmud has part of it, that you take it as folklore, history, culture, religion, science. And the central Talmud, because the central, go through all those sections and explain how they function. Now, we don't go through many examples because that will kill the entire purpose of the book. But it brings us those kind of things there. So a person can start getting a concept, what is the Talmud and why it's so important and why we need to learn it, so on and so forth.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Another work by your father is on some of the personalities that contributed to the Talmud. The book is called Talmudic Images. Do you have a favorite or interesting Talmudic figure you can share with us to give us something of a taste of your father's book?
Absolutely. So, my father did not pick everybody. He picked the people he thought are important for him, for my father, and what important for what he think they are the most significant of all. So, I will take two. One in brief. One is Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was one of my father's favorite sages, and I don't remember if it's in the book or not. But the idea of Rabbi Akiva is a guy that's starting his life very late. His spiritual journey only started when he's 40. He had this amazing love story between him and Rachel, which became his wife, who is the daughter of the third most richest person in Jerusalem at that time. It's an amazing love story, the way she encouraged him to go and learn. And he's like, you know, I'm 40. What the heck, man? I have sheep. I'm a shepherd. I'm not going to go learn now. Why do I need these people? They're nuts. Why do I have to sit down and run books all day? But she tells him, it's very important for me. Money I have and nothing to worry about, do it. Obviously, the moment she said that line, her father realized she's going to marry this shepherd and she needs to disown her. And then she becomes basically, she brings money home for herself and he goes to learn Torah for 24 years or 12 years, depends on the custom. Become amazing sage because apparently the man was very talented and very, very bright. Again, it's a sign, the reading of it, it's not just a reading of Rabbi Akiva. Is this guy is going from an innocent shepherd to a militant supporter of the great rebellions against the Romans in second century. He's a guy that has no problem to get to a major clashes with the authority. He's a guy that sits and sees destruction of the temple on one side, but going to war on the other side about trying to redeem the temple. it's a very peculiar personality, and I think it's the reason my father, if I remember correctly, it was one of his really favorite people. And the relationship between him and Rachel, his wife, really became, you know, they were almost synonymous to the love between Jacob and Rachel. This is apparently to do with Rachel, not to do with Jacob. It's the Rachel name that apparently brings it up. You know, Ricky originally in passion with her, and then eventually, you know, the story goes that after he became the great sage he was, he bought her the called Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. Bought her Jerusalem of gold. It was a jewelry, kind of a tiara that the women of Jerusalem used to wear. He got it us in then, and eventually the story goes that he comes back to Jerusalem and he has 12,000 students behind him. You know, huge. Later on, there's the soldiers who became, this is the students became the soldiers that went to fight against the Romans. They all been killed later. But for that moment in time, the conversation, he comes in, his father-in-law, which he did not recognize clearly because it's been 12 years and the men change from a shepherd to a scholar. A good movie, by title, by the way. Shepherd to a scholar. He comes to him and asks him what to do because he disavowed his daughter from any belonging. So what is he going to do now? Because he really loves his daughter and he wants to repay, but because he took her off, it's not just like, you know, it's not like he's saying, I'm not going to give you money. Actually, an oath you take. What is he going to do about it? And Rabbi Akiva asking his first question is, if you knew your son would be a sage, would you make the swear? I said, of course not. He said, if you know, and he went on and said, in the Kalba Savua, which is the father of Rachel, saying, if he knew Aleph Bet, I will not do the oath. So, I mean, Rabbi Akiva really came all the way from nothing to something. He really did the complete option, which is a great, in my view, this is a story, is it tremendous because it's mean that everybody have a hope. Doesn't matter, you can always start again. You can always have an option to start. And that's what Rabbi Akiva teaches. That is one scholar that I think my father in love with. I think at a certain point in time, we're probably going to compile everything he wrote about it. Maybe try to make another booklet just about Rabbi Akiva and Roch and his wife Rachel. You know, that's one. The second one is the famous pair, Rava and Abaye. Rava and Abaye were partners in learning, and they constantly debate throughout the Talmud. I don't know if they have 300 debates or 250 debates. There's a huge amount of debates. And in 90% of the time, maybe 95% of the time, Rava is the winner. Rava is the dictator, the law is being the law and the opinion, his opinion holds. And Abaye loses all the time. Six cases in the entire Talmud where he wins. And my father takes these two personalities, these two guys who seem like they're, you know, just two scouts, the two personalities on a book, right? It's not a big deal. It's not like it's a novel that, you know, you can develop this, you know, the spiritual growth and talk about the life. There's nothing there. It's really just reading between the lines where my father had the ability to do so, to find what was unique about these two and why the perspective on life was so different. So I'll give you a sample. I can give the audience and you a sample, a very basic example. In our tradition of learning, usually in every school, in a religious school, of course, that you learn Talmud, you start between fourth or fifth grades, depends on your school. And the first tract that you learn is tractate Baba Metzia, the Migel Gate. It's a tractate of dealing with all kind of interpersonal relationships with practical action. For example, the Talmud starts with what happens if you walk in the street and you find a garment. It's very nice. And you grab it in one side, and another guy said, grab it on the other side, and you both claim it's yours. Well, I found it first. How you divide it. And so on, all kind of things. So one when you start in school, it's dealing with the concept of a lost object. One of the commandments we have in the Bible is, and if you find an object, another object belongs to somebody, you have to return it. Not just you have to return it in the sense of you're putting a nice sign in your bag, in your supermarket, on your local U-crop or whatever you have in local area. It's more simple, more so. You actually, in the old time, used to go to the temple in Jerusalem. There was a stand or some kind of a huge rock or stone that people used to stand there and announce, I have found this and this. Anybody who has marking on it can come and claim it. And so that is the basic idea. You have to find an object, you have to return it. Now, the Talmud, because that's one of the nature of the Talmud, is to ask questions. Now, not necessarily we want an answer, not necessarily all the options of the answering are practical, but the question is there. And the question is, if I found an object, what is the time, where in the timeline this object become mine? So there's two options. Option number one is that the moment I picked it up. The moment I picked it up, you gave up. The best example for that is money. If you find money, or let's say a can of Coke, okay, or whatever you drink, a bottle of scotch, hey, you find a bottle of scotch on the floor, you pick it up. I don't know why you would do that, but presumably you pick it up. The moment you pick it up, everybody in the world know that you give up hope on it. Nobody thinks in the right mind you're going to go on out there, especially when it's come to modern money. There's no way to tell who it belongs to, unless you have amazing memory. You remember the numbers, the serious number. Nobody can do this. If you lost $100, nobody go back, right? The other option said no. The only time you can actually become yours is when I know that I lost it and I lost hope to get it. Now, the difference is very simple. Because if I picked it up before it belonged to you, before it belonged to me because you did not lose hope yet, right? So you still own the property. If you still own the property or the whatever it is, I have to go and announce it. I have to go and return back to you. But if I know that you lost hope, I can pick it up and it's mine completely. Right? So these are two sides. Do I lose hope immediately, or do I lose hope only when I actually practically know that I lost hope? Okay? And obviously, it still depends on what we're talking about. Something that is more important, you're not losing hope till you lose hope. Like you actually have to lose hope. If a person doesn't lose money but loses wallet or his credit card, okay, then you all of a sudden the person has much more of a it's automatically, right? You're not losing hope because you look home and you walk around and you touch everything you have, you look on the couch behind the corner, recommends a great place, things fall down all the time. The kids' room, the grandkids' room, the whatever it is, you're looking around for this because it's your wallet. It's not only some pieces of money. So the Talmud brings a major debate between Abaye and Rava. Abaye is in the mindset that you don't lose hope till you actually say, I lose hope, or you think it, you think it in your head. And Rava said, no, if the thing is no value or there's no marking on it, I don't care if you don't know about it. I think it's significant. You lost it. It's mine. Right? So that is the two characters. Now, they're debating in one way or another on this similar concept of ownership and responsibility and communal responsibility throughout the Talmud. As I said, Rava win all the time, Abaye doesn't. And one of the explanations behind it is the background. Rava came from a very, very, very powerful house. And he was well-to-do, well-to-speak, and very impressive man. And for him, finding any object, losing any object was probably insignificant, right? If take one of the top 10 in Forbes, losing $10,000 is like me losing 10 cents. It's insignificant. You come from, it's automatically, you realize that it's not important. It's not worth to spend the time now looking for this. If I can go to the bank and say, look, I lost the money, issue me a new credit card. Instead of a buyer, that's the way my father described him, a buyer was an orphan. And one thing we know today, modern psychologists, orphans are more clingy to things because they don't have their own. And until they get something, until they own something, they keep it all the way. They keep it as much as they can. They take ownership in a way that it says, look, it's mine forever. And therefore, a person like that come and describe his opinion. He says very clearly, I'm not losing hope till I lost hope. I'm going to go look for that. I'm going to look for that bundle of money by the city. And I'm not going to give up hope. And I'm not, that's the difference. But that's psychoanalysis of the information. Or this is a story about the people. In general, my father taught sages or scholars, He really went into the meaning of who they are. He tried to create the full characteristic of the individual he's dealing with, which, by the way, it's part of the thing, the beauty of my father's ideas. He did not look at the sages as remote scholars. They're not what we call, you know, the scholars of old. For him, they were living creatures. He had a relationship with them. I hope he didn't think that he spoke to them and answered them, but in his mindset, you know, they were alive. He understood them. He put it in the historical context, in the spiritual context, in the religious context, and some in the familial context. You know, if somebody married three women and the first to die, and he had no kids, it has a bearing on the way he perceived Jewish law. You know, it's a perception of how you read text. For example, one of the most obvious things like that is the way you read the Bible. The original Bible, as we all know, came in a scroll with no punctuation marks. So there's some verses that we don't know when the beginning, when the end. We made a decision because eventually you had to read this book. You have to make a line. But in reality, we don't know if the comma comes between this word or that word. And that changed the entire context of the story. For example, one of the concepts we have in the interactive Sanhedrin is the concept of the pool of resurrection. That after the person dies, they'll be resurrected. Okay? So the one proof, which not holds in the end, but instead we bring it, is it's a line that says about Moses, you're gonna lay with your forefathers, comma, and your people should be awakened and do idol worship. Okay? So that's where we read it today. But is an option to read this text completely different. You are laying down with your parents, with your forefathers, and rise. Your people, et cetera, et cetera. So we just don't know. And again, the Talmud brings it back and forth, and obviously the read it the way it's supposed to be read. But the many stuff of it. So the sages, if you take the emotional context, take the spiritual context, you take their existence, what they were in the world, the commas have a bearing. My father tried to do throughout his process with A, the easiness of learning. A person, every human being, and it's interesting because I don't think this is applied, obviously, not all of your audience are Jews. Obviously, every person has to do three things every day. That's my father's perspective, and I hold by it very strong. Person should give every morning, give something for charity. It's a coin, half a coin, quarter of a coin, a dollar bill, five, whatever. Every day a person should give something because that's to show he cares about the other, right? That's our external work. Then every person should do once a day at least learn the word of God. Oh, and it doesn't matter if it's the Bible or the Mishnah and the Talmud or its philosophical understanding of what divinity is. I don't care because that is the key. And third, a person has to contemplate oneself. Person to know who he is. Before, as we know, it's very important to think about your family, think about your kids, think about your work. All nice. A person also has to take a small part of the day, maybe 5 minutes, and be egotistic and be self-serving. And think in 5 minutes only about yourself. And the question you have to ask me today is today better than yesterday? That's very simple. That's the question in mind. Now, that if you take that concept, a person has to think, that's what my father actually held. And you're now implying this on those sages and all those scholars from our generation, all of a sudden it's important to know who they are. Now, we have, I think the Talmud has, I don't know, 500 or something like that, maybe more, of sages. We don't have this kind of background on each one of them. Obviously, we have more background on those who are very famous. For our great benefit, a lot of time, as they didn't have last names, or most people did not have last names in those days, the fact that somebody was, you know, Jack A. Smith of Jerusalem, you knew he was from Jerusalem. You know, it was not a question about it. You know, it was obviously that what he did. And he gave us some background also. But even that has an implication of how he thought, how he understood, how he comprehended everything. You know, and then he's, you know, you can also talk about the where they were on the line, on the timeline. Because some people, you know, were earlier, later, you know. So all these things my father tried to really bring constantly, a person that has, my father believed that you read the Talmud, is it's a live being. And you have a conversation with the sages, and the sages become what you do. You understand what they come up with these lines, even though some of the lines are as I mentioned, sometimes they are close to ridiculous, right? But you need to understand where they come from. Why would a person stay dissented? Why would a person believe in demons? Okay, I never saw one. I don't know anybody in my life who saw real demons, you know, the one, whatever description you want to put in. But it almost goes on 3 pages explaining what is a demon. And clearly, they believed in it in enough seriousness that they put it in. Now, so the question is, you have to ask it, what happened? And there's many other topics like that. You understand the context of time and place and effort is very important. So these two books are complementing each other in a sense. You know, with the Talmud, when you start looking on, we try to put a short synopsis about every sage in the Talmud. That's available, of course, already in the book. But between the essential Talmud and the biblical and the Talmudic images, by definition, I bring together this kind of a more of a background to my read, that all of a sudden this read or learning of the Talmud becomes something of significance, of importance, and it's not just shallow. It's basically trying to move the page from 2 dimension to 3 dimension. And once you do that, I think the Talmud learning, or even glimpses of Talmud learning, are amazingly fascinating.
Rabbi Meni, as always, it has been a pleasure having this conversation with you. Thank you for taking the time.
All right. Till next time.
Friends, you've been listening to New Books in Jewish Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. Until next time, goodbye.